Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and you're listening to Chronicles and Commons. This is an episode that I'd really hoped to save for Halloween time frame, but I am currently working on a bigger project for this show, sort of like the H.P. Lovecraft miniseries. I've got a miniseries that I'm kind of putting the finishing touches on, and it's just not quite ready, so I needed something to fill the gap, and so this one got yanked out from the Halloween time slot and put in here. And that's okay. We might be able to revisit this topic closer to Halloween or associated topics. There are plenty of creepy, horrifying topics to touch on in the Halloween season, so I'm not too worried about that. The topic I'm sort of talking around right now is vampires. Vampirism. I heard on an interview with Tracy Hickman, who you may recognize from as the co-creator of Dragonlance. Certainly that's where I knew him from. Turns out he's also the creator or co-creator of Ravenloft, the Dungeons & Dragons campaign setting that's probably one of their most, aside from Forgotten Realms, probably the most popular campaign setting for Dungeons and Dragons. But I was listening to an interview with him, and he mentioned, because The Curse of Strahd was coming out at the time, he mentioned in the interview that the influence for Strahd when he was originally writing Strahd for Ravenloft was not, in fact, Bram Stoker, but a short story by an author named John Polidori, who had written this fiction piece, published in a periodical called the New Monthly Magazine back in 1819. So that predates Bram Stoker by, I don't know, 50 or 60 years, and apparently was kind of a big deal at the time. It's counted as a major influence on a lot of the following, what we can call modern vampire fiction thereafter. I don't know for sure that it's the first major work about a vampire, but apparently it made enough of an impression that most people consider it the first successful story to take vampirism and put it into a sensible modern story that modern audiences would want to read. Keeping in mind that when I say modern, I mean early 1800s. So really what I wanted to do for this episode was take a look at some of the folklore of the vampire mythos. But unfortunately, I don't know where to begin to look for that kind of information. I'm not an anthropologist, so I'm kind of limited to random internet searches. But the interview with Tracy Hickman did lead me to this Polidori short story, and I gave that a read. And that in turn led me to a book by Richard Francis Burton. That's not to be confused with Francis Bacon, who is completely a different person. This is Richard Francis Burton, who was a merchant, I think, and a world traveler in the late 1800s. And he ended up in India and wrote down some folk tales that he'd heard whilst in India about a creature called a Batal. Okay, so let's start with Polidori first, just because it is dated 1819, so that's before 1870, which is when Richard Francis Burton's book was released. But we'll acknowledge that neither of these are truly source material, because both borrow from the whatever folklore gave rise to the idea of a vampire at all. But in the vampire is the name of the story. It's called Vampire, A Tale, and this is by John William Polidori. And in this short story, it is just a short story. It's a quick read. If you want no spoilers at all, you need to fast forward to 11 minutes and 26 seconds right now. It's available on Gutenberg.org. You can also listen to it on LibriVox.org. So both of those places will get you through the tale. In the book, the short story, The Vampire, the lead vampire is Lord Ruthven, a British nobleman who somehow gets integrated into the high society of London and meets a young gentleman named Aubrey. Aubrey and Ruthven travel around Europe for a little bit together, and in Greece, Aubrey meets an attractive innkeeper's daughter, who he becomes infatuated with, and they talk, and this lady tells Aubrey of these legends of a vampire. Well, speak of the devil, as they say, because not much later that evening, the innkeeper's daughter is killed, drained of her blood, killed by a vampire. To overcome his shock and grief at the death of his new lover, Aubrey decides that he and Count Ruthven should go tour the rest of Greece, the parts of Athens that they had not yet seen, because that's where they met the innkeeper's daughter. So they kind of wander around Greece for a bit and encounter a group of bandits or robbers who shoot Ruthven, and Ruthven falls and is dying, and Aubrey comes to his side to aid him, but Ruthven says simply that there's nothing he can do, but that Aubrey must swear an oath that he will not mention his death or really speak of Ruthven at all ever again to anyone, no matter what. And Aubrey agrees. What can you do? The guy's dying. So he said, yeah, sure, I won't speak of you to anyone ever again. So Aubrey goes back to London and is quite amazed when Count Ruthven is there, not dead, alive, and he's just sort of hanging out in London like normal. And in fact, Ruthven starts to court Aubrey's sister. Now, Aubrey and his sister are orphans, and so Aubrey is quite protective of his sister. And because he saw Ruthven die, like in his arms, and because Ruthven is now courting his sister, Aubrey has a nervous breakdown, and he's placed under watchful care of whatever sort of mental health professionals they had back in 1819, and is pretty hopeless for much of the latter half of the story. Now he starts to recover a little bit in the end, and he realizes that his sister is engaged to marry Ruthven, and they are engaged on the day that Aubrey's oath to not speak of Ruthven is scheduled to end. It was a timed oath. It was like a year or something, and so it's her marriage to Ruthven is exactly the day that he's allowed to start speaking about Ruthven's death, according to his own oath. Now, I felt it was a little bit strange that he would be so duty bound to an oath that he would let it interfere with the protection of his sister, which is also, I would think, would be a higher duty than keeping an oath to some dude who I'd met and just palled around Europe with. But there is some, first of all, it's 1819, and I don't exactly know what their sense of honor was, but I've kind of heard that it was a big deal back then. Worth dying over, certainly. People used to have duels. So there's that. But also in the story, it is mentioned many, many times that part of his nervous breakdown, part of his loss of his senses, is that he continually hears Count Ruthven's voice saying, remember your oath, over and over and over again. He just can't get it out of his head. So he feels threatened. He feels very, you know, it's not just that he's duty-bound to this oath, it is that he's being compelled to keep the oath, possibly by a force that is greater than his own will. So Aubrey is on his deathbed at some point, and he writes a letter to his sister that details everything about Ruthven and reveals that Ruthven is actually a vampire, and that Ruthven, in fact, killed the innkeeper's daughter back in Athens. But sadly, it does not arrive in time. Ruthven marries Aubrey's sister. On the wedding night, she's discovered dead, drained of her blood, and Ruthven, of course, is nowhere to be found. And that's The Vampire. That's the story by John William Polidori. There are similarities to this story in the later, more famous vampire story that certainly as I was growing up, I kind of, as far as I knew, that was the only vampire story. It was Bram Stoker and Dracula. That was, as far as I'd ever heard, that was vampire, right? So this one predates that, and I think that there are some things where you can really kind of look at this and realize that this probably influenced Bram Stoker quite a bit. Not only do you have the person, like the young man, sort of having to challenge the worldly and lordly count for the affections of some young woman, whether it's the innkeeper's daughter or his sister, in both cases, you kind of do get a Jonathan Harker vibe from Aubrey, superficially probably, but I mean retrospectively, you could see how those could have Aubrey may have influenced Jonathan Harker's character. And how possibly either the innkeeper or the sister could, probably more the sister. The innkeeper you don't really see for very long, but the sister could definitely be Mina Harker. You can also see how Aubrey, during his madness, would be the inspiration for Renfield, and then, of course, Ruthven himself would be the vampire, so Dracula, I guess. And so there are some parallels there. There are some definite, some influences to be seen. In terms of what we can glean from this writing, in terms of what vampires can and cannot do, though, it's not quite as structured. I mean, Bram Stoker's definitions aren't super structured either, but there is a sense of what Dracula can do. You can extract that from the story anyway. But the things that we do learn from Polidori is, first of all, that vampires may be resurrected. They don't resurrect on their own, as far as we can tell. So here's a paragraph from the book so that you can get an idea of what it takes to resurrect a vampire. So, rising early in the morning, he was about to enter the hovel in which he had left the corpse when a robber met him and informed him that it was no longer there, having been conveyed by himself and comrades upon his retiring, to the pinnacle of a neighboring mount, according to a promise they had given his lordship, that it should be exposed to the first cold ray of the moon that rose after his death. Now that, as far as we can tell from the book, that was the resurrection of Lord Ruthven. There is some indication also that Lord Ruthven might have a supernatural power over maybe the atmosphere to some degree. I mean, when he first attacks the innkeeper's daughter, for instance, there's thunder and lightning and things like that. There's certainly an influence that you can rather extract from how the book is written, that there's a certain kind of terror that just sort of falls over a town when there's a vampire feasting on one of their inhabitants, like the innkeeper's daughter. So I it doesn't exactly say that the vampire caused people to sense his presence or caused people to be suddenly stricken with fear or for the thunderclouds to open and let forth lightning. It just happens to be there when it all happens. So you get this sense that maybe there, I mean, it could just all be down to colorful writing, but I don't think that it would have been there if it wasn't significant that the vampire was at that time feasting on the innkeeper's daughter's blood. Interestingly, though, the vampire doesn't seem to spawn any new vampire. So there's no, you know, when Aubrey returns to England from Athens, he doesn't arrive to find Ruthven and his new companion, the innkeeper's daughter, as a vampire, for instance. That's not what goes on here. So I don't get a sense from this book that a vampire sort of creates, you know, the vampire spawn in the way that we, our modern day rules sort of prescribe, that if they drain the blood and, I don't know, chant three times and click their heels, then they're creating a vampire. But if they just drain their blood for effect, then they just are dead, or whatever the rules are. I've never been super clear on when people turn into vampires versus when they don't turn into vampires. I've always felt that within the vampiric mythos, I've always felt that was a little bit unclear. Yeah, and this doesn't help with that, except to say that apparently they don't spawn. So it's not something that you can catch, the vampire bug. You can't get that from a bite, for instance. You have to be somehow otherwise created. We don't know how. I prefer to think of some kind of religious or unreligious or sacrilegious rite or ritual, but it doesn't say in the book. And that's mostly what the book does. What I've described just now, that's kind of how the book presents the vampire. Someone who's pretty classy, happens to kill people, and when he's in this killing mode, he strikes fear into anyone in the, a 20-foot radius or so. But ultimately pretty terrifying in a frankly a fairly Lovecraftian sense, meaning that it seems that the author expects you to be so horror-stricken by the brutality of what a vampire does that you will go out of your mind, or you will just be afraid of it. And that's a very classic literature kind of thing where you're just expected to faint from the sheer horror of these things. And modern sensibilities, obviously, we can take that now. We don't care. We're not going to faint just because someone drained someone else's blood. You have to do something a little bit more for us. But at that time, the idea was that if you heard about such an atrocity, you would be gutted. You would feel so miserable that you may even lose your sense of reason. You might even go insane. And of course, that is exactly what happens to Aubrey. Although there is a sense, again, of a supernatural influence on him, since he keeps hearing Ruthven's voice in his head saying, "Remember your oath, remember your oath." So I think it's a healthy mix of mental influence and an abject horror at what can happen within this world by supernatural means. And I think that's probably the takeaway, is that vampires are ruthless, and they're named Ruthven. They are horrific, and they have influence over others. That's a pretty good takeaway from Polidori. Now, in terms of how this affects your potential campaigns or stories or your internal logic of vampire mythos is really obviously up to you. It actually subtracts a lot from the vampire mythos, which, I mean, that could be good, could be bad. One of the quintessential things in vampires, as most of us know vampires, is that kind of contagion aspect of it. If you're bitten, then you are a vampire spawn essentially, and you now have, you're the vampire who created you is now your master, and that's where the hierarchy comes from, and all of these weird things that people have invented over a century or more of vampire stories in I think largely pop culture. I don't think a lot of this comes from the folklore. I could be wrong, of course. I could be totally wrong, but that's, I'm not really sure where all that comes from. But anyway, whatever we're used to, what Polidori wrote lessens that considerably. It goes on with a lot of the things that we already had, like the supernatural influence over things, and then takes away the contagion aspect. But maybe that's kind of what you want. Maybe you don't want to have to bother with people becoming vampires after they get killed by a vampire. Maybe that's not your style. So you could do that. Another option is to force players to cut the heads off of a fallen friend who may become a vampire if they don't. And then with a magical device that you find out about in the next book that I'm going to talk about, not in this episode, but next episode, they can reattach the head and revive the player with some magic, not as a vampire, just as a soulless person again. In terms of what Dungeons and Dragons and Pathfinder and all of our favorite fantasy RPGs do with vampire mythos, I think it tends towards the traditional. Obviously, in Ravenloft and in Curse of Strahd and the character of Strahd, there's a pretty definite story there about how Strahd had this lover who died, but then sort of reappears through time, and he has to continually sort of rediscover this reincarnation, I guess, of his lover. So that's and his powers tend to be pretty common traditional vampire powers. In Pathfinder Chronicles Classic Horrors Revisited by James Jacobs, Rob McCreary, and F. Wesley Schneider, there's a chapter on vampires, and once again it tends toward our common pop culture definition of what a vampire can do. Specifically, though, I found it interesting, having actually read Polidori's work, the specked-out vampire in this work is named Audbrey, A-U-D-B-R-E-Y. So one letter away from Aubrey. He's a male human vampire fighter. He's an aristocrat. He's a medium-sized undead creature with special abilities including blood drain, change shape, children of the night, which means that he can influence wildlife around him. So that's straight out of Bram Stoker, really. Create spawn. So he can, when he kills a humanoid, he can then raise them again as a vampire servant. Dominate, he can crush a humanoid's opponent's will as a standard action. That's, of course, right out of Polidori. Energy drain, where he can cause someone to gain two negative levels, which is kind of horrifying. Gaseous form, so he can poof into fog, just like Strahd. Shadowless, he casts no shadows, so I think that's another Bram Stoker thing, I think. I don't really remember. And then spider climb, he can spider climb over a ceiling or a wall. So I'm going to wrap up the episode there, because that's a pretty good coverage of the first work. And in next week's episode, I will go over Richard Francis Burton's Vikram and the Vampire book. It's a much longer book, so I'm not going to be able to summarize it as well as I have this short story. It's several hundred, a couple hundred pages, like 100, 200 pages, whatever. I don't know. I had an ebook, so it's hard to tell. But it's a bigger work. It has some different implications. Certainly a very rich history. And so we'll go over that next time. Thanks for listening. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.